Welcome to our deep dive into Micah chapter 4. The sources you sent over are really interesting. They really highlight the contrast between this chapter and the earlier ones in Micah. It's a complete, well, almost a complete 180.
Right.
You've got these pronouncements of doom and destruction in chapters 1 through 3. It's especially aimed at Samaria and Jerusalem. Micah, this 8th century BC prophet, by the way, it was around the same time as Isaiah.
Oh, wow.
Just to give you some context.
Yeah. I think what's fascinating about those earlier chapters is that Micah doesn't just predict the destruction. He really gives you the reasons behind it. He calls out the corrupt leaders, the false prophets who are just kind of peddling empty promises. And he even talks about the destruction of the Lord's house. And you can just imagine what a weighty statement that was for the people of that time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's heavy stuff. And he doesn't hold back at all. And then, boom, chapter 4, we get this totally different vibe. It's all about restoration and hope. And it's this unexpected shift that makes Micah 4 so intriguing. So are you ready to unpack it?
Absolutely. Let's dive in.
Okay, awesome.
So Micah starts with this grand vision of Jerusalem's future glory. He talks about the mountain of the Lord's house being exalted, people from all nations streaming in to learn God's ways, and the Torah going forth from Zion. It's really this incredible picture of a world transformed by God's truth.
Total paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he even uses the phrase, in the last days. Now, someone could look at that and think, oh, this is end times. Is that what Micah's really getting at here?
Not necessarily. I think it's important to remember that for Micah, the concept of the last days and even the distant future really points to this idealized future, something that unfolds over a very long period. I think a better way to think about it is as a vision of God's ultimate reign, a time when his purposes are fully realized.
So it's less about a specific point in time. Mm. And more about this ongoing process of restoration and God's plan for his people ultimately coming to fruition. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Now, this theme of restoration, we've seen that in other prophetic books like Isaiah and Daniel. It seems like this recurring motif in the prophets, this idea that God will ultimately triumph over evil and establish his reign of peace and justice.
Yeah, definitely a common thread throughout the prophetic books.
Okay, so how does this vision of peace in chapter 4 connect back to those false prophets that were promising peace in the previous chapters? They're both talking about peace, but it feels very different.
Oh, yeah. The difference is stark. You know, those false prophets, they were offering this superficial, surface-level peace, one that didn't really require any change or transformation. But Micah's vision hinges on people actually learning and embodying God's teachings. It's a peace that comes from aligning ourselves with God's will, not from ignoring or downplaying our wrongdoing.
Yeah, it's like the difference between putting a Band-Aid on a wound and actually treating the underlying infection. Micah is calling for deep, lasting change, not just a quick fix. And now we get to another interesting element, the image of the daughter of Zion. I don't know about you, but when I first read that phrase, it struck me as a little odd.
Yeah.
But there's got to be something more to it.
Yeah, it's definitely more than just a poetic way of referring to Jerusalem.
Right.
It's really a powerful personification that reveals something deeper, I think, about God's heart.
What is the significance of this personification, though?
Yeah.
And how does it connect to this idea of restoration and God's longing for his people?
I think through the daughter of Zion, we get this glimpse into God's own vulnerability, his deep emotional investment in his people. There's a real tenderness there. Even in the pronouncements of judgment, Micah uses phrases like so beautiful and so delicate, really highlighting this profound, I even say almost parental love that God has for Jerusalem.
It's like we're seeing a different side of God here, a side that I think often gets overlooked, his heartbreak over the choices that his people are making and the consequences that they're facing.
Absolutely. And it's important to remember this imagery isn't unique to Micah. We see it in Isaiah as well, specifically Isaiah 62.11, where the daughter of Zion is promised a savior. So it's this beautiful thread of hope that's woven through the pain and exile. Even in the darkest moments, God's love and promise of redemption remain constant.
Okay, so chapter 4 presents this picture of both security and suffering, almost side by side. You know, Micah talks about everyone dwelling peacefully under their own vine and fig tree, but then throws in these "but now" statements that kind of bring in this harsh dose of reality.
Yeah, Micah 4.4, with its promise of security, it directly echoes 1 Kings 4.25, which describes the peace and prosperity during Solomon's reign. It's brilliant. Micah is giving his audience this concrete historical example of this idyllic peace, something they can really grasp and long for.
It's like he's saying, remember that time of peace and abundance. That's what I'm talking about. That's what God desires for you. But then he hits them with these "but now" oracles, and the tone totally shifts.
And the way he does it is so powerful. That repetition of "but now," ata in Hebrew, it creates this sense of urgency and immediacy. It's not just a contrast between past and future. It's a direct personal confrontation with their present reality.
And ata also means you, right?
It does.
It adds a whole other dimension to these statements. God is saying, yes, there's this glorious future ahead, but you right now are facing these specific challenges.
Exactly. It's a call to action, an invitation to examine their present reality in light of God's promises.
So what are some of those challenges that Micah outlines?
Well, he talks about the lack of leadership,
yeah,
outcry from the people, the looming threat of exile to Babylon, and even hostile nations gathering against Zion, ready to destroy it.
Wow. And that reference to Babylon, that's a fascinating detail, because Micah is prophesying during the Assyrian crisis. Babylon wouldn't become a threat for another century or so. So he's looking beyond the immediate crisis, demonstrating this prophetic foresight,
yeah,
like almost reminding his listeners that, yeah, you're dealing with Assyria now, but there's a bigger picture. God is working with a much longer timeline.
Exactly. Even amidst those bleak "but now" pronouncements, Micah is still weaving in these threads of hope. Exile might be on the horizon, but there's also the promise of eventual deliverance. Suffering and crisis are definitely part of the journey, but they're not the final destination. God is still present, still working to redeem and restore his people.
It's a powerful reminder that even when things seem hopeless, God's purposes are still unfolding. We may not always understand his ways, but we can trust that he's ultimately working for our good. Okay, so we've got these hostile nations on the scene, ready to attack Zion. Micah describes them gathering like a storm clad, intent on profaning God's sacred space.
The imagery there is incredibly vivid. He paints this picture of them gazing with contempt and greed, highlighting the depth of their hostility and their desire to completely obliterate Zion. And notice the verb "gathered" is passive.
Oh, you're right. It suggests that even in this hostile gathering, God's hand is somehow at work. That's a bit unsettling, to be honest. Why would God orchestrate this gathering of his people's enemies?
That's a great question. And I think Micah provides some answers through this powerful image of the threshing floor.
Okay, when I think of a threshing floor, I picture this wide open space where farmers would separate the grain from the chaff. How does that connect to these hostile nations and God's plan?
Well, Micah is playing on multiple layers of meaning here. First, remember the threshing floor of Arona.
The one that eventually became the site of the temple. Yeah, I remember that. That's an interesting connection.
Exactly. So right away, we have this link between the threshing floor and God's presence. But then think about the process of threshing itself. It involved this heavy sledge being dragged over the grain to separate it from the chaff.
Oh, now Isaiah 41, the threshing sledge is actually used as a symbol of power and judgment.
That's right.
So when Micah talks about these hostile nations gathering on this threshing floor, he's setting the stage for a massive reversal. They think they're coming to destroy, but they're actually walking right into God's plan.
You got it. This is where it gets really interesting. Remember that image of the daughter of Zion we talked about earlier?
Mm-hmm.
The one who was depicted as vulnerable and delicate?
She's not going to stay vulnerable for long, is she?
Not at all. Micah takes this image and completely flips it on its head. Suddenly, the daughter of Zion is no longer the one being threshed. She becomes the thresher herself.
Wow, that's a powerful shift. But how does she go from this fragile figure to a force to be reckoned with?
Well, Micah uses these incredibly vivid images to depict her transformation. He says she will thresh her enemies, gore them with horns of iron, and trample them with hooves of bronze. She becomes this unstoppable force wielding God's power to crush her enemies.
So the nations who came to conquer and destroy end up being the ones who are crushed and broken.
Talk about a plot twist, right?
Right. It's amazing. And those horns of iron, that imagery is significant too. Mm-hmm. In the Old Testament, horns often symbolize power and victory. Like we see that in 1 Kings 22 and Deuteronomy 33.17.
Right.
So Micah is equipping the daughter of Zion with the very symbols of strength that her enemies thought they possessed.
Exactly.
Like he's saying, you came here with your weapons and your arrogance, thinking you could conquer God's people, but you're playing right into his hands. You're about to face the true source of power. What happens to all the wealth and plunder that these nations have accumulated through their violence and injustice?
Well, Micah doesn't mince words. He says it will be devoted to the Lord for destruction. He uses the term haram, which is a powerful word in the Old Testament,
yeah,
often used in the context of holy war, where things are completely obliterated, utterly destroyed as an act of purification.
So it's not just about taking their wealth away. It's about completely purging it from the land, cleansing the sacred space from the stain of their ill-gotten gains.
Precisely. And it underscores the absolute authority of God. He alone determines the fate of nations, the ultimate outcome of their actions, the very things they thought would bring them power and dominance, end up being the instruments of their own destruction.
This is incredible. We've covered so much ground already. We journeyed from pronouncements of doom to visions of restoration, from the vulnerability of the daughter of Zion to her incredible transformation into a powerful force for justice.
Micah 4 is packed with so many layers of meaning. It's a challenge to unpack it all.
It is. Before we move on to part two of this deep dive, is there anything that really stands out to you so far?
What fascinates me is the intricate way Micah weaves together these seemingly opposing themes: judgment and mercy, destruction and restoration, vulnerability and power. It's like a tapestry where each thread, even the darkest ones, contributes to the beauty and complexity of the overall design.
And for you, what resonates most deeply?
You know, for me, it's the reminder that God's ways are not our ways. We might not always understand his methods or his timing, but we can trust that he's ultimately working for our good. Even when things seem chaotic and uncertain, his purposes are unfolding, and even our darkest moments can be used for his glory and our ultimate transformation.
What a great place to pause. Join us for part two, where we'll dig even deeper into Micah's message and explore the implications of this incredible chapter for your life.
You know, it's remarkable how Micah 4 moves from these grand sweeping pronouncements about the future to these incredibly personal and specific moments of suffering and deliverance.
That's true. Like in the section about gathering the lame and those who have been thrust out, the language Micah uses feels so intimate and poignant. It's like he's zeroing in on the individual pain within this larger narrative.
He's highlighting the most vulnerable members of society, the ones who are often overlooked and forgotten. You know, those who are physically and emotionally wounded, bearing the scars of their struggles.
Like, he's saying that no one is insignificant to God, that even those who feel broken and marginalized are included in his plan of redemption.
He gathers them like a shepherd tending to his wounded flock.
I like that.
And that word lame that Micah uses, it's the same word used to describe Jacob's injury after wrestling with God in Genesis 32.
Oh, wow.
Remember how Jacob was left with a limp? It wasn't just a physical limitation. It was this constant reminder of his encounter with the divine, a symbol of his own brokenness and dependence on God.
So Micah's connecting the physical experience of lameness to this deeper spiritual reality, the feeling of being broken, incomplete, in need of God's healing touch.
Exactly. And this imagery really ties back to that stream of people flowing towards Zion. They're seeking guidance, protection, and ultimately healing for their woundedness. Just like a flock instinctively follows its shepherd, these people are drawn to God's presence, recognizing their need for his care and guidance.
It's a powerful image of hope and restoration. A reminder that God sees our pain, our struggles, our vulnerabilities, and he offers himself as the ultimate source of healing and wholeness. But then Micah throws in this detail where God acknowledges that he's the one who brought them to this state of suffering. And that feels a bit jarring at first. Why would God do that?
It does seem harsh on the surface. But remember those earlier chapters where Micah called out the people's disobedience and their refusal to follow God's ways?
Yeah, he was warning them about the consequences of their choices.
Exactly. So this acknowledgement of God's hand in their suffering, it's not about him being cruel or vindictive. It's about upholding his covenant, reminding them that actions have consequences, and that turning away from him ultimately leads to pain and brokenness.
So it's a reminder of God's justice, his commitment to holding his people accountable for their actions. But even in judgment, God's love and mercy are still present. Micah doesn't leave them in despair. He offers hope, even amidst their suffering.
Yeah, there's this constant tension throughout the Bible between God's justice and his mercy. It's not always easy to reconcile those two aspects. But Micah seems to be saying that they're both essential parts of God's character and his plan for his people.
That's a good point.
And Micah emphasizes that God is ultimately working to restore his people, to transform them into a strong nation. He even uses that phrase, from now to the distant future again, highlighting the enduring nature of God's promises. He's reminding them and us that his plan is not limited to a single generation or a particular historical moment. His purposes extend across time and space, encompassing both the immediate present and the distant future.
Wow, that's a powerful reminder that God is working at a much grander scale than we can often comprehend. But then Micah throws us another curveball with yet another but now statement. And this time he brings back the image of hostile nations gathering against Zion. Feels like we're back to square one. The cycle of conflict and opposition just keeps repeating.
Well, Micah's a master at weaving together these different threads, you know, moving back and forth between hope and hardship, between God's promises and the realities of human brokenness.
It's a reflection of life itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we experience moments of joy, peace, and blessing, but we also face challenges, setbacks, and seasons of suffering. And Micah isn't afraid to acknowledge both sides of that reality.
Exactly. And in the section, he brings us back to the immediate historical context, the Assyrian crisis that was looming over Judah at the time. He describes these hostile nations, most likely the Assyrians, with incredibly vivid language.
Yeah, he talks about them wanting to profane Zion.
Yeah.
To make it a public spectacle of destruction. And the phrase that really struck me was how they gaze upon God's people with contempt and greed. You can almost feel the weight of their hatred and their desire to completely annihilate everything that Zion represents.
It's chilling, isn't it? But amidst this chilling description, Micah drops in another one of those passive verbs. Remember how we talked about the word gathered being passive earlier?
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Well, here it is again.
So once again, we're confronted with this idea that God is somehow orchestrating this gathering of his people's enemies. This is a challenging concept to grasp, this notion that God would allow, even facilitate the suffering of his own people.
It certainly challenges our human understanding of how God should act. But Micah invites us to consider a different perspective. Remember that image of the threshing floor we talked about?
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Yeah.
It's not just about destruction. It's about purification. Mm-hmm. Those hostile nations think they're coming to obliterate Zion, but they're actually playing a role in God's plan of refining his people.
Yeah.
Separating the wheat from the chaff.
Exactly. The very act of violence and oppression that they intend for evil, God uses for his purposes. And it's not just a passive allowing. Micah presents God as actively directing this process.
It's almost like he's saying, you might think you're in control, that you're the ones driving this assault, but I'm the one who's ultimately in charge. I'm the one who's using your evil intentions to accomplish my purposes.
And those purposes involve not just the destruction of the wicked, but also the purification and transformation of his own people. Remember the image of the daughter of Zion, the one who was initially depicted as vulnerable and wounded.
Yeah, she's about to make a serious comeback, isn't she?
That's an understatement. Micah takes that image and completely flips it on its head. He transforms the daughter of Zion from a victim into a victor, a powerful force wielding God's judgment.
So how does this transformation take place? How does she go from being the one who is threshed to becoming the thresher herself?
Well, Micah uses a series of incredibly vivid images to depict this radical shift. He says she will thresh her enemies, gore them with horns of iron, and trample them with hooves of bronze. It's a powerful depiction of God's righteous judgment being unleashed through his chosen people.
The nations who came to conquer and destroy end up being the ones who are conquered and destroyed.
The irony.
It's amazing.
And Micah emphasizes the irony of the situation, pointing out how the nations march towards their own destruction without even realizing it. They're so blinded by their own arrogance and greed that they fail to see the true power they're up against.
And what happens to all the wealth they've plundered, all those ill-gotten gains they thought would secure their dominance?
Micah uses that powerful word haram again. He says their wealth will be devoted to the Lord for destruction. It's not just about confiscation or redistribution. It's about complete and utter obliteration, a purging of the land from the stain of your wickedness.
It's a striking image of God's justice and his commitment to cleansing his creation from the corruption of evil.
And it underscores the absolute authority of God. He alone determines the fate of nations. He alone has the power to overturn the plans of the wicked and to bring justice and righteousness to his creation.
This is incredible. Micah 4 is packed with so much drama and intrigue, so much theological depth. It's a challenge to keep up with all the twists and turns.
It's a reminder that the Bible isn't just a collection of stories or moral teachings. It's a living, breathing word that engages with the complexities of human experience, the struggles we face, the questions we wrestle with.
Before we move on to part 3, what's one thing you want our listener to take away from this section of Micah 4?
I think the key takeaway is that God's purposes are always unfolding, even when we can't see them, even when we don't understand them. He can take our most painful experiences, the things that seem like setbacks or defeats, and use them for our good and his glory. He can transform our vulnerability into strength, our weakness into power.
It's a powerful message of hope and resilience, a reminder that even in the midst of chaos and uncertainty, God is in control. His promises are sure, and His love never fails. Join us for part 3 as we explore the final section of Micah 4 and discover how this ancient prophecy speaks to our lives today. We've explored Micah's stunning vision of a future where nations flock to Zion to learn God's ways, and we've witnessed the daughter of Zion's dramatic transformation from vulnerable to victorious. But Micah doesn't end chapter 4 on this purely triumphant note. There's this one more element he brings in, and it might be the most challenging one of all.
Yeah, you're right. There's this dose of realism. You know, Micah injects into this prophecy, he acknowledges that even in this idealized future, not everyone will choose to follow God. Even when God's truth is shining brightly, some will just stubbornly cling to their own paths.
It's a reality check. This idea that even when God's kingdom is established, there will still be these pockets of resistance, people who choose darkness over light. And Micah doesn't shy away from that at all.
No, he doesn't. He states it directly in verse 5. Though all the peoples continue to walk each in the name of his gods, we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever. It's powerful, almost like a line in the sand.
And the way he emphasizes that we, it creates this sense of solidarity, this distinction between those who choose to align themselves with God and those who don't.
Exactly. Micah's reminding us that following God is a choice. A choice that we have to make, not just once, but every single day. Even when we're surrounded by people who worship other gods, who chase after empty promises, we have to stand firm in our commitment to the one true God.
It's like choosing to walk a different path, even when everyone else is heading in the opposite direction. Which can be incredibly difficult, especially when we feel that pressure to conform, to fit in, to go along with the crowd.
Oh, it's a challenge, no doubt. But Micah doesn't leave us to face this challenge alone. Notice how he uses that plural we again. He's emphasizing that we're part of a community, a body of believers who are all committed to walking in God's ways. We're not isolated individuals. We're part of something much bigger than ourselves.
It's that concept of the faithful remnant. Even when the majority goes astray, there's always this core group who remains true to God, who keeps the flame of faith burning brightly. And Micah is encouraging us to be part of that remnant, to find strength and support in each other.
Absolutely. You know, we need each other to stay strong in our faith, especially when the world around us seems to be pulling us in a different direction. It's so easy to get discouraged, to lose sight of what truly matters, to compromise our values in order to fit in or avoid conflict.
But Micah is calling us to something higher, something more enduring. He's calling us to stand firm in our convictions, to live out our faith with courage and integrity, even when it's unpopular or inconvenient.
He reminds us that following God is not just about inward belief. It's about outward action. It's about walking in His paths, making choices that reflect His character and His teachings.
Aligning our lives with His will, not just in words, but in deeds. That's where the rubber meets the road.
It is. But Micah reminds us that we don't have to do it perfectly. We just have to keep striving, keep seeking God's guidance, keep choosing to walk in His ways, even when we stumble or fall short. He's gracious and merciful, always ready to forgive and restore us when we turn back to Him.
So Micah 4 ends on this note of both challenge and hope. He challenges us to make this conscious choice to follow God, even when it's difficult, even when we're surrounded by those who choose a different path.
And He offers us hope. He reminds us that God is faithful to His promises. He will ultimately vindicate those who trust in Him, and His love will prevail over darkness and despair.
Micah 4 is an incredible chapter, packed with vivid imagery, challenging truths, and ultimately a message of hope that transcends time and circumstance.
It's a message that speaks to the deepest longings of the human heart, this desire for peace, for justice, for a world where God's will is done. It reminds us that we're not just spectators in this grand cosmic drama. We're participants, called to play a role in the unfolding of God's plan.
And it's a message that continues to resonate with us today, challenging us to live out our faith with courage, conviction, and a steadfast hope in God's unwavering love.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Micah 4. It's been an honor to explore these profound truths with you.
We hope you found it insightful and encouraging. And perhaps this deep dive will inspire you to keep seeking, applying, keep exploring, and keep trusting in the God who promises to make all things new.